Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David. How are you?
Great.
And good evening, everyone. Tonight we have a very special guest, Amy Odom, the director of litigation of one of the most influential groups in the country in terms of veterans' benefits and advocacy on behalf of veterans. Called the National Veterans Legal Services Program. Very excited to have Amy tonight.
Yes, I'm very pleased that Amy Odom is on the show tonight. I look forward to hearing her insights about not only the National Veterans Legal Services Program, but also some very important issues facing veterans. For all our listeners around the country, remember that the Veterans News Hour is a show that welcomes your views, your comments, and your questions. So you can call us anytime during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, those of you grabbing your pen and paper now, it's 1-888-627-6008. That's our number.
And let me begin with an introduction of our guest. Amy F. Odom is the Director of Litigation for the National Veterans Legal Services Program. She is admitted to the practice of law before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. She was a member of the District of Columbia Bar. As Director of Litigation, Ms. Odom represents veterans and survivors before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and other federal courts, and she trains, develops, and supervises other NVLSP staff attorneys. Ms. Odom's practice also involves mentoring and advising pro bono attorneys representing veterans and survivors through NVLSP's Lawyers Serving Warriors program, as well as pro bono attorneys representing appellants through the Veterans Consortium Pro Bono program. Ms. Odom has served as the treasurer of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims Bar Association and as vice chair of the American Bar Association's Section of Administrative Law and Regulatory Practice Veterans Affairs Committee. She is an expert on VA benefits for disabilities caused by military sexual trauma. Her achievements include contributions to many veterans' publications, as well as to several editions of what many consider the finest publication on veterans' issues, the Veterans Benefits Manual. Prior to joining the National Veterans Legal Services Program in 2008, Ms. Odom served as an attorney advisor in the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Administrative Law Judges. She is a graduate of the University of Florida College of Law, where she competed on the school's moot court team and served as a public interest fellow with the Center for Government Responsibility. Ms. Odom also earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Florida.
Welcome, Amy. How are you tonight?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Oh, it's really our privilege for you to be with us tonight. We thank you so much. We'd like to begin, if you would start off by telling us about the National Veterans Legal Services Program, such as its mission, its history, resources, those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are a nonprofit organization here in Washington, D.C., we've worked since 1980 to ensure that the government delivers to our nation's 25 million veterans and active duty personnel the benefits to which they are entitled as a result of their military service. We were founded, our history, our story actually goes back before 1980 when a man named David Addlestone, who was an Air Force JAG, finished his military career, but decided to hang out in Vietnam a little bit longer, helping folks get some discharge upgrades. And he was joined in the late 70s by one of our current executive directors, Bart Stichman. And then in 1980, they actually founded the organization National Veterans Legal Services Program. They started off doing mostly discharge upgrade work and some other things. And then in 1989, our other current executive director, Ron Abrams, joined us after a 12-year career with the VA. He came with a lot of knowledge and background about VA law, having even helped to write the adjudication procedure manuals and regulations over there.
Wow.
And so since then, we've grown a lot. We've grown a lot even since I joined the organization in 2008. I got involved in veterans law having graduated from law school in 2006. I was in law school at the time that Iraq was getting pretty serious. When things were getting pretty bad in Fallujah around
right.
that time. And I distinctly remember thinking, you know, this was the biggest thing to happen to my generation.
Right.
Yes. And that, you know, I really felt a duty to answer the call to ensure that, you know, my generation wasn't left behind, as many felt that the veterans of the Vietnam generation was. So I came up to D.C. from Florida. I packed up all of my belongings and my dog and my old Ford Explorer and drove all the way up from Gainesville, Florida to Washington, D.C. with my check engine light on, and the rest is history.
Wow. Well, that's super, yeah.
That's awesome that you saw that calling, Amy, please tell us about it, the NVLP's many services available to help veterans and their families.
Sure. Well, we have several different departments in the organization. The department that I'm in charge of, the litigation department, focuses primarily on litigation or appeals to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, which is not part of the VA. The Veterans Court, as it's commonly referred to, is a court that Congress created in 1989 so that veterans could receive independent judicial review of decisions made by the VA on their benefits. Something that a lot of people don't know is that prior to 1989, you couldn't go to court for VA benefits. The VA's decision on your benefits was final, and there was no right to a day in court like you have today.
Which was unusual, considering other administrative agencies, you typically would have had that and still do have that right to go into court. So
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
The VA lived in what many have called splendid isolation, meaning nobody was really looking over their shoulder, making sure that they were doing things correctly. So that's my department. The other department, another department that we have is the Trainings and Publications Department. That's run by my colleague, Rick Spataro, who's the director of that department. He's a Navy vet. He was a surface warfare officer for a long time before starting his law career. The Training and Publications Department is responsible for the Veterans Benefits Manual that you had so kindly mentioned earlier. It's a lot of work. We're in the middle of updating it right now. It's about 2,000 or so pages of everything you ever really wanted to know about veterans benefits plus some.
Right.
So they're in charge of the manual. We also have webinars that we do about every 6 weeks touching on different topics that are relevant to veterans advocacy. We have them available on our website for both VSOs, veteran service officers, and attorneys. We also do a lot of training for both VSOs, veteran service organizations, and attorneys on a one-on-one basis. So
that veterans benefit manual that you mentioned, about 2,000 pages, for those in our audience out there that aren't familiar with it, I have to tell you, from my perception as a lawyer who's practiced in many different areas all over my career, it's the best single volume, in-depth resource that you will that I've ever seen for any area of the law. It truly is outstanding, and I'm not just saying that. It truly is. I cannot imagine any veterans advocate, whether they're a veteran service officer or whether they're a lawyer or otherwise, functioning in this area of the law without the Veterans Benefit Manual. And for those that aren't familiar with it, you can find it and order it from the nvlsp.org website. I just thought I'd mention that for you. Amy, can you tell us about some of the class action cases which your organization has been involved in over the years?
Sure. The one that we're probably most known for is the Niemer class action. That was a class action that was filed in the late 1980s that sought to force the VA to acknowledge that there was a link between exposure to Agent Orange and certain cancers. Prior to this time, VA was unwilling to make that link. So not only was the lawsuit successful in forcing the VA to acknowledge this link, but also as part of the settlement agreement with that class action, we worked out an agreement where every time VA acknowledged a link between Agent Orange and a new disease, VA is required to go back and give the veteran or his or her survivor benefits all the way back to the date that the veteran first brought a claim for that disease. So,
and your organization, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So in other words, the most recently VA acknowledged a link between coronary artery disease and Agent Orange. And that only happened within the last 10 years. But if a veteran actually filed a claim for coronary artery disease in 1981 and now gets service-connected based on the new rules that acknowledge a link between the Agent Orange and the coronary artery disease, that veteran's benefits can go all the way back to 1981, which for a lot of people is a pretty hefty sum of money.
Wow. Yeah, it certainly is. And that's that case you mentioned, Niemer, for those listening, it's NEHMER, Niemer versus the United States Veteran Administration. pretty landmark case. And Amy, is your organization, correct me if I'm wrong, your organization has a role in kind of holding the VA's feet to the fire. Is that correct?
That's right. As I mentioned, the most recently added disabilities to the list of diseases that VA recognizes are linked to Agent Orange includes coronary artery disease and Parkinson's disease. And we are still going through decisions and making sure that VA properly pays the retroactive benefits to those veterans who were previously denied, and also making sure that those veterans and their survivors are getting the benefit of concurrent retirement and disability pay, as well as combat-related special compensation, which is another area that we are focusing on. And in fact, just filed another class action suit involving CRSC, combat-related special compensation. And for those listeners who might not be familiar with that benefit, for a long time, the rule was that if you were retired based on longevity or a medical retirement from the military, you couldn't receive both your retirement pay and your VA disability benefits. Now, that general rule has been eroded over the years, where especially for longevity retirees, you are entitled to at least a portion of both your retirement and your VA benefits. But for combat-related special compensation, this is a payment that you can receive in addition to your VA benefits if you were medically retired from the military. And it's something that's relatively new since about 2008, around there. So the class action that we recently filed involves the amount, how far back your combat-related special compensation benefits can go. We believe it can go back, for at least medical retirees, we believe that it can go back to at least 2008 when Congress passed the law that allowed the concurrent receipt. But the service departments are taking the position that the earliest it can possibly go back is 6 years. So, in other words, if a person is awarded combat-related special compensation today, who is a medical retiree, his or her benefits would only go back to 2011. And we think there's three more years of benefits on the table that the service departments aren't giving up. So we just filed that litigation a few months ago, a month or so ago.
Wow.
And we're hoping that that will be successful. We are also well known for our class action litigation in Sabo versus the United States. This is a class action that we filed in 2008 involving people who were forced out of the military due to PTSD. Generally, what we found when we looked at these cases is that these were people who had multiple deployments during OIF and OEF, oftentimes with infantry MOS, who were then diagnosed with PTSD while they were still in service. And the military would put them through the medical evaluation process and to determine whether to separate them, would find that the diagnosis of PTSD rendered the person unable to continue in his or her particular MOS, and then separate them rather than retire them. So what that means is that the person would get a disability rating for the PTSD that was less than 30% through the military. If you get a rating of 30% or more through the military, you get retired, and with that you get the lifetime retirement compensation as well as lifetime TRICARE for you and your dependents and some other benefits as well. Now, these folks were getting ratings of less than 30%, turning around, filing a claim with the VA as soon as they got out and getting rated at 70 to 100% by the VA. So there was a major disconnect between the ratings that the military was giving and the ratings that the VA was giving. So we filed a lawsuit in that case, and we actually ended up settling with the government, and the government agreed to go back and give everybody affected at least a 50% rating and put them on the temporary disability retirement list, then reevaluate them and give them the rating that the VA gave them.
Wow.
So a lot of people who were separated from the military with no benefits ended up getting retired from the military with lifetime benefits. So that was
wow.
a major win for us, and we helped over 1,000 veterans.
Amy, so when you said that they would be guaranteed a minimum of a 50% rating for PTSD, then as you said, if they had a higher rating by the VA, the military would have to honor that higher rating as well?
That's right. So not everybody walks away with a minimum 50%. Some people
right.
were rated less than 50% by the VA.
I see.
A lot of people were rated higher, much higher,
right.
and therefore walked away with lifetime retirement. And even people who were not rated at 50% by the VA as soon as they got out, but were rated at, say, 30%, those folks got lifetime retirement, too.
Wow. That's a pretty important thing. And I've seen a lot with some of my clients. It seems like the VA psychologists and psychiatrists tend to routinely understate the severity of PTSD and depression and anxiety compared to private doctors, private psychologists. And it sounds like from what you were describing in the Sabo case, that the military kind of got caught doing the same thing on a system-wide basis. But that's fascinating. So, one thing that I really applaud your organization for is not only the individual representation, but the class action cases like the Niemer case and the Sabo case. And Amy, in addition to those, what would you say are some of the current issues which your organization is currently addressing, if you can share that with us?
Yes, absolutely. So most of the major work that we're doing, aside from the appeals and the training, is through our Lawyer Serving Warriors department, which is yet another department in our organization. And Lawyer Serving Warriors, we have a few focus points in that program. One is the combat-related special compensation that I was just talking about. We work with a network of pro bono attorneys throughout the country in assisting people in filling out their applications for combat-related special compensation. We also do some work with discharge upgrades, looking at cases where veterans were given personality disorder diagnoses in service, and then separated rather than retired, or separated rather administratively separated rather than put through the medical separation process due to that diagnosis. We have a program where we're looking back in those cases and seeing if maybe the personality disorder was a misdiagnosis and there was actually something else going on, especially if the discharge was for misconduct that was related to a mental health diagnosis that perhaps wasn't made, and instead there was a personality disorder diagnosis in service.
So can I ask you about that? When you say personality disorder, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a situation, that's a disability that the VA will not consider service-connected, correct, as opposed to PTSD or depression or anxiety or some other things. That being labeled with a personality disorder is something that the VA will consider not being service-connected. Is that correct? Is that basically kind of the crux of the problem?
Yeah, that's right. Personality disorder is considered to be a congenital or hereditary disability, as opposed to, say, PTSD or major depression or even schizophrenia, which is considered to be an acquired psychiatric disability. Acquired psychiatric disabilities are disabilities for VA purposes, whereas congenital defects, which is what they call a personality disorder, are not
right
disabilities.
Right.
But some of the other programs that we have through Lawyer Serving Warriors include, we have a program to assist veterans who were victims of military sexual trauma in service. We have a program to assist those veterans in proving entitlement to VA benefits.
Could you tell us more about that? Because that's a really big issue that we see, not only with our clients, but just we know it's being reported more and more in the media, the problem of military sexual trauma, and you know, I consider you an expert in that area. Can you share with us more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So you're right. It is a really big problem. VA on its website has cited a survey that they conducted where 1 in 4 women veterans reported that they experienced some type of military sexual trauma, which is really disturbing if you think about it. If you know 4 women who were in the military, chances are that one of them was subject to military sexual trauma. And it's not just a woman's issue. The same survey revealed that 1 in 100 men reported in-service sexual trauma. So these numbers are likely low because even in an anonymous survey, most people are probably not comfortable answering honestly. So it's not, while it's more prevalent among women, it's not just a woman's issue. But some major challenges that people face when they do decide to pursue help and benefits through the VA is proving the trauma. Because just a simple fact of life is that most sexual traumas go unreported, and this is true in the military as well.
Right.
So the good news is that in recent years, VA has really taken a good hard look at this area and has made improvements. So, for example, there are ways to get mental health counseling and treatment for physical issues that might be related to military sexual trauma that doesn't require even proving or being service-connected for those disabilities. You can do that through your MSC coordinator, who can put you in touch with the Veterans Health Administration or the VA Medical Treatment Center, and you can get help that way. And the MSC coordinators are usually at your regional office, so you can find out more information on the VA's website about who you should contact locally. But it gets a little bit trickier when you start talking about the benefit side. And one major problem is that one of the most commonly diagnosed mental health issues related to military sexual trauma is PTSD. And the way VA's regulations are is that if you want to get service-connected for PTSD, you have to have, quote-unquote, credible supporting evidence of your in-service trauma. So what that means is that for most veterans, your statement alone isn't enough to prove what happened to you in service. What's ironic about this is that this is a rule that applies only to PTSD claims. If the same veteran wasn't diagnosed with PTSD but was diagnosed with anxiety disorder or major depression, that veteran's statement alone could be enough to prove the in-service trauma, because that special language, credible supporting evidence, doesn't apply once you get out of PTSD. Isn't that crazy?
It sure is. Is that something that, I wonder if there's, I try to track pending legislation, and I'm unaware, perhaps you know, I think it would be a good idea that rule be changed to make it consistent with other things. I don't know your thoughts on that, but.
Well, so the regulation that I'm talking about, and if there are any law nerds out there, it's 38 CFR 3.304F. That applies to all PTSD claims. So combat-related PTSD claims and non-combat-related PTSD claims, including MSC. Not to get into the weeds too much, but combat veterans, usually their statements are enough. And they are enough under the regulations, so long as you can prove combat service. In addition, if you served in Iraq or Afghanistan or some other combat zone, there's a lower evidentiary threshold for you. But if your PTSD diagnosis is related to something else, like, for example, if you witnessed somebody else in an accident or something like that, that was not is not combat related and not related to what they call hostile military or terrorist forces, then you have to have credible supporting evidence. So the regulation dealing specifically with MSC provides other examples of evidence other than service records that can be used to prove the trauma, because, again, it's highly unlikely that you'll be able to prove the trauma through your service records, because it's highly unlikely that you ever reported what
right.
happened. So VA and some other people think that the regulation providing that other evidence outside of the service medical records can help to prove the stressor. They call that a reduced evidentiary burden. But the fact of the matter is it's not as reduced as it would be if you didn't have PTSD, and that's true regardless of the cause of the PTSD. I'm not aware of any legislation pending, and I don't believe that there are any regulations or proposed regulations pending that would fix this. I do know that this particular issue has been challenged in the courts a long time ago, and the courts ended up siding with the VA that this was a reasonable regulation.
Right. Now, when you said that, and I certainly appreciate this, that a lot of instances of military sexual trauma go unreported, and I think that's true for both men and women. We've represented both men and women who have been the victims of military sexual trauma. But and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though something is not, even though an incident is not reported, let's say to law enforcement, we can look to other markers or other indicators. Some people might call circumstantial evidence that would indicate that something bad happened to this person. Like a severe drop in duty performance, changes in behavior, going AWOL, substance abuse, things of that sort. Is that fair to say? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's right. They call them behavioral changes. The regulation uses the word behavioral changes. Also, in some cases, a doctor like, say that the trauma occurred in 1972. A doctor saying in 2017 that the veteran's diagnosis and the veteran's psychiatric presentation is consistent with somebody who suffered sexual trauma could also work to prove that the trauma occurred in service.
I had a case similar to that about 10 years ago. It was a male Marine Corps veteran who had been sexually assaulted by a male NCO at boot camp in San Diego back in 1961, whenever he was 18, when the recruit was 18 years old. And being in boot camp, it's an extremely, as we all know, extremely intimidating environment. And back in that time frame, there was a lot of physical abuse of many sorts that was kind of the standard. But this young Marine was sexually assaulted on multiple occasions, and stated that his life had been threatened if he reported it. He didn't go AWOL. He didn't start doing drugs, but a psychologist years later, in reviewing his life history and the broken relationships he had, and including a very obsessive compulsive nature, that instead of going AWOL and fleeing work, he became extremely obsessive and compulsive in his work. And the psychologist used that among other markers to say, yes, this was consistent with someone that had been traumatized, and eventually won the case, and he received 10 years, going back to when he filed the claim. It was a long time in appeal, but he really had a lot of courage. I applauded him for finally having the courage to tell what happened.
That's really wonderful. I recently, well, not recently, but a few years back, had a case of a woman who served in the Army in the 1950s, so you can imagine how her experience was.
Right.
And she also suffered military sexual trauma, and we were able to prove, 60 years later, her entitlement to benefits. So that was pretty rewarding as well.
I think
that's
those
awesome.
Are good. Those are good examples,
yeah,
that perhaps should encourage our listeners out there that may be a veteran that has experienced this, or that knows a veteran that has, they should encourage them to come forward both for treatment, but also that the VA should be taking care of them, not only in terms of treatment, but disability compensation.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah. Richard, did you have a question?
Yeah. It's a topic that's going to continue to, unfortunately, be very prevalent in the whole veteran system. But, Amy, what are, with regard to the NVLSP's ideas, what ideas do you all have to improve the VA's claims and appeal system, particularly the length of time it takes for cases to progress through the appeal system? You know, now that we have a new secretary, and there appears to be, you know, new legislation coming forward, what's your organization thinking in terms of moving this appeal process?
Well, so we think that appeals reform is definitely needed. I don't know if you all saw the GAO report that came out last month.
Yeah, I saw it.
So we are familiar with, you know, the three-year time lag between filing the appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals and actually getting a board decision. So, you know, for a veteran who's totally disabled and unemployable, 3 years is an eternity. And it's just a shame that this delay happens, and it's not even clear why it happens. You know, and the GAO said that if changes aren't made, that three-year delay will turn into 8.5 years by 2026. I think it was 2026. But
the director down in St. Pete went even further, and she said that if things don't change, it's going to be 10 years. I know from experience that probably the number one question I get asked, and I get asked this question every day by many of our veterans that we represent, is how much longer? And it's very hard as their attorney to try to answer the question and to give them hope. You know, we have a motto, persistence erodes resistance, but, you know, to try to keep these veterans going and to avoid the frustration that they must feel, it's awful.
And I personally, if I can interject, I think the statistics, you know, the VA has been challenged over the years for unreliable statistics, both on the healthcare side and to some extent on the claim side. I think the statistics, as far as the wait time for the processing of appeals after a notice of disagreement is filed, is actually much longer. And I know this is kind of anecdotal, you know, in the part of clients that Rick and I represent. But you know, our clients will often wait at least 2 or even 3 years. To get a BVA hearing, and then we may wait at least 6 months, sometimes as long as a year, to get a decision from the BVA judge after the hearing.
And it's a remand.
And then it's remanding, and it's going back to the same regional office that made errors in the first place. And we've also encountered something that's interesting. I don't know if this is also your experience, Amy, but whenever we've had the decision review officer hearings at the regional office, it seems like in many issues, if it requires really any judgment as far as fact-finding or applying the law, we've had decision review officers that candidly have told us, well, you're just going to have to appeal that to the BVA. They're just not going to. It's an unwritten policy. We've asked them for their policy in writing, which they'll refuse to give us. But their apparently unwritten policy is the punt.
To take that even one step further, these same decision review officers would say to us, well, you know, I probably could resolve that, but I really think you should take it to the BVA and let them do it. I'd feel more comfortable if they would make that decision rather than I make the decision. And then I would say to them, but you can make the decision. Right. And they would candidly say, I can, but you better take it to the BVA, right in front of the veteran.
Right.
Right. The only exception to the kind of that attitude that we've encountered at the St. Pete Regional Office have been a few cases involving widows of deceased veterans, where the decision review officers have said during the hearing, it's almost as if they're afraid of the BVA getting a hold of that case that involves a widow seeking dependency and then the compensation, for instance. It's like they know and they'll acknowledge the BVA allegedly does not want those cases. So it's just kind of interesting. I just thought we'd share with our thoughts. You were mentioning, Amy, about, I think there's kind of uniform agreement that the VA's appeal system needs to be reformed. The length of time is really ridiculous. I'm just kind of concerned about what those reforms might include, particularly when there's proposed legislation that would take away the VA's duty to assist once it's made the initial decision on a case, prior to the first NOD. I'd be interested in hearing, your organization is at the top of the mountain in my view. I really would welcome hearing your views on that particular issue.
Well, so we do support that there are two lanes in the BVA appeal process. You're talking about the legislation that made it through the House in 2016.
Exactly. Yes.
Created these three levels, or these three options. Once you got the initial decision from the regional office, and the only one where the duty to assist really continued was to file the quote-unquote supplemental claim within the year and keep everything at the regional office. So that legislation did say that although the duty to assist didn't apply after the initial decision unless you filed a supplemental claim, there would still be room to argue, I think, that about the duty to assist, because the way that I read the legislation was that both the board and the higher review authority would be able to go back to see if there was a duty to assist violation prior to the issuance of the initial rating decision. So while admittedly not ideal that the VA's duty to assist would not apply after the initial decision, I think there's still enough room for argument that there were duty to assist violations that had to be cured. Now, also, if you have a good advocate at the regional office level, you can get all the evidence together before you get to the initial decision and have everything laid out. And, honestly, oftentimes when a veteran submits a fully favorable, perfect medical opinion, VA will still go to its own doctor to get a medical opinion. And a lot of times the VA's opinion will be unfavorable.
Right.
And then they'll rely on that to deny the claim. So in some cases, it might work to the veteran's benefit that they can't go out and get a new opinion. The new legislation also had provisions that would require VA in some cases to accept the private medical opinion, which we definitely support that. Some other areas that we think would improve the appeals process is to not have the board be able to remand anymore. Instead, the board would go out and develop its own medical evidence instead of remanding it to the regional office. If a medical opinion was required, the board could do that. Currently, under the law, the board can't go out and develop new medical evidence except for VHA opinions in some circumstances. But we would like to see them just have broad authority to develop new evidence. Now, of course, the board would have to provide any new evidence to the claimant and give the claimant an opportunity to respond or rebut the evidence. But we think that that would cut back in a lot of remands. Because, you know, if you look at the board's, the chairman's annual report for fiscal year 2015, about 46.5% of cases were remanded back to the regional office. That's almost half of the board's decisions aren't actually final decisions, they're remands. So if the board were able to do its own development, we could see that number cut back a lot.
And then of the other 50% or so that involve a decision, I would assume that that includes both BVA decisions that grant the claim, but also those that just flat out deny it that result in an appeal to the court, which correct me if I'm wrong, there's also a very high rate of remands from the Veterans Court back to the VA, correct? I mean, so
that's
you see a lot of the
right.
remands and the further development necessary. And I'm just a bit concerned about, you know, with these supplemental claims that you mentioned, whether it's just it's continuing kind of the hamster wheel thing, which is, you know, the veteran files a claim, the regional office makes the decision, some cases without very much real development. So they make a denial, sometimes quick, sometimes not so quick. And then the veteran is left with, under this new legislation, a couple choices, can go to a decision review officer, but then loses, under the new legislation, would lose the right to submit any new evidence to the DRO, who is simply looking at the record and no longer has a duty to assist, or can file supplemental claims within a year, which is just more claims. I mean, I'm just wondering. I personally think, for what it's worth, is that there's a tremendous understaffing problem at the regional office here in St. Petersburg. It's my understanding they've got roughly about 900 or so employees, and of those, we've been told by various DROs the number of decision review officers are roughly about 30. That number apparently fluctuates for various reasons. But to me, when you've got a backlog at the regional office of about 30,000 post-NOD claims waiting for, you know, for the regional office to act on the next stage, it's not surprising it's going to take them at least 2 and usually 3 years just for that next decision. I personally just don't see the proper management by the regional office to make it happen. I think they're certainly smart enough to change things, and to me, the fact that they haven't just suggests they really don't care. That maybe that's just my cynical viewpoint. But,
well, you know, I think you've hit on something there, because the GAO report that came out last month emphasized the need to hire more staff to do if VA is going to get out from behind this appeals backlog, it's going to need to hire more staff. And that was the recommendation of the VAO. I know for a fact that this is happening at the Board of Veterans Appeals, which
Amy,
is a good sign.
We heard that they recently hired 46 new BVA judges. Do you think that's going to have a considerable impact?
Yes, absolutely. I can tell you that my department of the organization, which is responsible for appealing decisions of the board to the Veterans Court, we're bracing for an onslaught of cases coming in, you know, 2018. I would expect to start seeing a lot of them.
Well,
what's interesting is
that's terrific.
Go ahead, Amy, I'm sorry.
The Veterans Court, too, has been for a few years now bracing itself for an onslaught of appeals, which we just haven't seen yet. In fact, last year in 2016, the court docketed fewer cases than it did in 2015. Now, not thousands fewer than it did in 2015, a few hundred fewer, but that was a surprise. We thought that we would see a lot more. And, you know, currently there are several vacancies at the Veterans Court due to recent retirements. We've got another one coming up this summer. So we're hoping that this administration and Congress will act quickly to fill those vacancies, because otherwise we're going to see some pretty long wait times at the Veterans Court as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I certainly hope that they will. Do you think that the fewer appeals to the court has been for any specific reason? Like, has the BVA been increasing its percentage of remands that then can't be appealed directly?
You know, I don't know. We've all been kind of scratching our heads about it. To be honest with you, I haven't studied those numbers, the remands versus the grants. And actually, that's because the chairman of the board hasn't issued the fiscal year 2016 report yet, so we haven't seen those numbers. As far as I can see on the website, I looked for it today and I couldn't find it.
Okay. Well, we certainly appreciate all the info that you have, and that GAO report that you mentioned, I think is interesting, because as I understood it, it seemed like the GAO wasn't taking the VA's word at face value. The GAO was basically, taking the position that the VA does need someone looking over their shoulder, and thank goodness for the GAO. That's all I can say. But I also get emails almost daily from, you know, the VA's newsletter system, and a lot of them are from the VA's IG system itself. So I don't know what your perception is on the VA IG system, but, periodically I see some really good kind of self-critical reports. I just hope that the VA acts on them. So, Amy, if you could, I know we're getting close to the end of our show, and we really, really thank you for being on our show. Can you tell us how our listeners out there can learn more about your organization? You've mentioned a lot of good resources and free programs, and what can people do to support your organization?
Well, sure. You can find out more about us at our website, www.nisnational, V is in Veterans, L is in Legal, S is in Services, P is in Program.org. You can find out about our current programs and what types of cases we're taking now, and to include the discharge upgrades, the military sexual trauma cases, and some other projects that we're working on. You can read some press releases about the CRSC website that I discussed. There's some information on there about the Niemer lawsuit. You can purchase some of our products, including the Veterans Benefits Manual and our webinars. We have a library of past webinars, plus, like I said, we have new webinars every 6 weeks or so. So pretty much anything you wanted to know about us, you can find there.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I check it out frequently, and as I said earlier on the show, I'm a big fan of the organization and particularly the Veterans Benefit Manual, which I've bought yearly for the last 20 years since I've been doing veteran law. So it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. And Amy, we thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Thank you. We're big fans of the Veterans News Hour.
Well, thank you, and we certainly invite you back whenever it's convenient to you, and I'm sure our audience will enjoy hearing the latest from you about veterans' benefits. So thank you. Thank you again.
Thanks very much, Amy. And before we wrap up the show, I'd like to make an important VA program, which we have discussed in previous weeks and which is worth repeating tonight. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a tough time transitioning to civilian life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. Toll-free number is 1-888-823-7458. That's 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458.
Yep, and along that same note, if you know a veteran who's suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the VA has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. those of you that still have your pen and paper out, the toll-free number for the crisis line is 1-800-273-8255, and then press 1. That's 1-800-273-8255, and press 1. And, it's time for us to go for this evening. We'd like to thank, again, our special guest tonight, Amy Odom, and thank all of you for listening to our show here on BBS Radio. We'll be back next Monday, same time, same station, BBS Radio Station 1. You can listen to our archive podcast of our prior shows at bbsradio.com, the Veterans News Hour. We'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Doug Newsom, and invite our listeners to become show guest sponsors and advertisers. Our contact information is on our show's website, bbsradio.com/The Veterans News Hour. So that's our show for tonight. Please tune in next week for another great show.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.